Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. Today's speaker will be Karen Lystra, Professor of American Studies at California State University at Fullerton and author of Searching the Heart, Women, Men, and Romantic Love in 19th Century America, and Dangerous Intimacy, The Untold Story of Mark Twain's Final Years. She'll deliver the annual Henry W. Casper S.J. Lecture in History. Dr. Lystra will speak on the topic Love Letters, Revealing the Intimate Past. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, February 13, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Heather Fryer, Chairman of the Department of History and the Henry W. Casper Professor of History at Creighton University.
This afternoon, we welcome Karen Lystra to Creighton University. I first encountered Professor Lystra's work early in my development as a historian and came to appreciate the richness and the significance of studying the private past. Her book, Searching the Heart, clearly illuminated for me that while enjoyable and relatable and even kind of juicy from time to time, private writing requires careful, skillful, and deeply respectful contextualization and interpretation. Because historians of private life don't just hold the behaviors of historical actors within well-crafted historical frames, they hold the hearts of historical actors in their hands. Caring in this way for those who are no longer living can only be a labor of profound love that makes not just the subject of Professor Lystra's lecture especially appropriate for Valentine's Day, but also the intellectual rigor and the emotional intelligence of her scholarly practice itself. A professor of American Studies at California State University, Fullerton, Karen Lystra is a 19th century cultural and social historian with a special interest in class, gender, the history of emotions, and private life. The cultural values, rituals, ideologies, and behavior surrounding courtship, marriage, and sexuality are examined in her first book, Searching the Heart, Women, Men, and Romantic Love in 19th Century America, published in 1989. Her second book, Dangerous Intimacy, The Untold Story of Mark Twain's Final Years, published in 2004, is a biography focused on the pivotal role that Twain's inner circle, and particularly his youngest daughter Jean, quite a character, played in the last years of his life. Professor Lystra is currently working on a book about 19th century working class Americans that I'm very much looking forward to seeing when it's out. It is with great pleasure, then, that I turn the floor over to our guest, Professor Karen Lystra.
Well, that was a great introduction, so we can just all go home now, can't we? I want to thank Heather Fryer for that wonderful introduction. As you know, she's chair of the Department of History and American Studies, and she holds the special Casper Professorship in History, so she's quite busy. I want to thank her for organizing the lecture today. I would also like to thank Jesse Taylor Maynard, administrative assistant, for getting me here with airplane tickets and hotel reservations and all the necessary things to coordinate a guest coming to Creighton University. When Alexander Graham Bell made his great and infernal invention work for the first time on March 10, 1876, he was stuck with an old-fashioned method of communicating his joyful news. He had to write a personal letter. He couldn't call anyone yet. I was in one room at the transmitting instrument and Mr. Watson at the receiving instrument in another room, out of earshot, he wrote his father. I called out in the transmitting instrument, now known as the telephone, Mr. Watson, come here, I want to see you. And he came. The day is coming, Alexander Graham Bell wisely prophesied, when telegraph wires will be laid onto houses just like water or gas, and friends will converse with each other without leaving houses. Thus began the slow decline of letter writing in America. The U.S. Postal Service reported in 1980 that only 20% of the total volume of letters it processed was personal. neglecting the impact of, that's 1980, just wait. Neglecting the impact of the telephone, Forbes magazine claimed that, quote, in the 1980s, faxing was the first attack on snail mail. They're not historians. Perhaps the most seismic shift in letter writing began 15 years ago, according to Forbes, quote, with the pervasive availability of free email. Today, mobile devices provide texting and social media, shifting the acceleration away from physical letters. In 2013, the Postal Service pegged the number of letters it delivered at 158 billion, seemingly huge until you compare the 4 billion Facebook messages sent in 2010 and the 250 billion estimated email messages sent daily. Few people I know keep copies of their email, never mind the vast array of personal expression in social media. Some historians, full of doom and gloom, foresee a time when we will lose the ability to view the past through letters altogether. I know the crucial importance of letters in revealing the intimate past. My work on American middle-class courtship, marriage, and sexuality in the 19th century could not have been done without letters. In fact, without personal letters exchanged between men and women of that era, the stereotypes of Victorian culture based upon advice books or prescriptive literature would remain largely unchallenged today. Those Victorian stereotypes are familiar. Victorian women were sexless or passionless, so the old history assured us, emphasizing that our forebears were repressed in both body and mind. The birth control of choice, according to the stereotype, was total abstinence. 19th century married men, this narrative suggested, had to get most of their physical satisfaction from prostitutes. The stereotypical image of Victorian America, a term that refers to the middle classes in the period from 1830 to 1900, roughly Queen Victoria's reign, this stereotype is one of a totally prudish, uptight culture that even covered piano legs. My research began with an intuition that something wasn't right about this picture. There was no one left to interview, however, and with one exception, no significant body of social science questionnaire data available. Historians were claiming at the time that the only body of retrievable information on intimate relationships was the medical and moral advice of 19th century ministers, doctors, and cultural reformers. I suspected there was a difference between that advice and what people were actually thinking and feeling, not to mention how they were behaving with each other in private. But I wondered how I could ever find the data to investigate questions of intimacy in an era so shrouded in secrecy. Looking backward, the place to go was obvious, but it was not obvious to me then. I was looking through a glass darkly. I stumbled upon the evidence I needed by accident. Deciding to read straight through a family manuscript collection at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, one of the largest repositories of rare books and manuscripts in the English-speaking world, I stumbled upon a set of love letters. A manuscript collection, just to be clear, can consist of 1 to 300 boxes of material created in the historical period by the people involved. After reading the love letters in this manuscript collection, I was stunned by the intensity, the openness, and the range of expression of feelings, as well as the descriptions of behaviors that took me into the private recesses of people's lives. Thus began my search for love letters that took me on a 4.5-year odyssey through the Huntington Library archives. On a mostly random basis, I found thousands of love letters, which formed the foundation of my challenge to the stereotypes of 19th century middle class or Victorian culture. Before I summarize some of my conclusions, which would not have been possible to substantiate without those letters, I would like to comment on the act of letter writing and reading itself, which can change over time. with so many immediate technologies of connection, late 20th and 21st century correspondents might not respond to letters with the same feelings as 19th century correspondents who reported to each other that the experience of reading or writing a letter was like having an intimate face-to-face conversation. Nathaniel Wheeler, an aspiring teacher, underscored his feelings of intimacy while he was writing, "I'm just talking as I would if you and I were cuddled up in the dear old lounge in the corner. Oh, how I enjoyed it." Another man wrote, after reading his girlfriend's letters, "It was a perfect luxury to read and reread it. I could almost fancy that I heard your sweet voice and could look up and see that quiet eye gazing on me. Why I enjoyed it so very much, I really don't know, except that it all somehow seems so like what you used to say when I was near you." A young woman, Augusta Halleck, expressed practically identical sentiments to her boyfriend. "Reading your letters, James, seems like having a long conversation with you." Confederate officer Eldred Simpkins confessed to an even more evocative behavior. "Whenever I get one of your letters," he wrote his girlfriend, "I always look to see to the end, to see how long Lisa has talked to me, and then I lock my door and have you all to myself. I cannot bear to read your letters near anybody, but will keep it in my pocket until I am all by myself. In fact, I treat your letters as I would yourself. Have you all to myself." The impulse to read a love letter behind closed doors underlines the tangible presence that the letter assumed. Clubwoman Clara Baker described her letters from Robert as actual visits and acted accordingly. "I wait down for the mail, but when it has been distributed, they see no more of me. For as now, I spend the rest of the evening with my lover, my Robert, my darling." As romantic love grew more intense, the 19th century couple seemed more and more likely to anthropomorphize the letters of the loved one into the person of the absent lover, reflecting the virtual merging of the letter and the self of the beloved. Correspondents reported a series of unexpected, emotionally charged responses. Popular lecturer Robert Burdett confessed, "Dear Violet, your letters, they have so much of your own personality in them. They are so much you that I sometimes find myself talking to them." Attorney Albert Janin reported when he received his girlfriend's letters, "I kissed your letter over and over again, regardless of the smallpox epidemic in New York, and gave myself up to a carnival of bliss before breaking the envelope." Freud, where are you? Perhaps the most unusual and revealing anthropomorphic act was captured in Circuit Judge Lincoln Clark's request to his wife, Julia. "Pray write often as you can, and when you write, put on your open black dress and beautiful white underdress." Mining engineer James Haig also graphically personified his wife in letters. "I got your letter. I just want to take you in my arms and put my face against yours and give you a sweet old-fashioned hug. You see, it was nice to get a letter after having so many postal cards." Postal cards are all open and before folks. And to get a letter sealed and private is something else. It was like going upstairs after being in company all day with other people and finding ourselves alone and taking each other in our arms and hugging and kissing to our heart's content. The emphasis on privacy was crucial. The content of expression and behavior in Victorian culture was rigorously controlled according to its place or social location. Love letters were expected to be a place that was totally private, where communication was virtually unfettered by polite forms. In terms of social norms, the public-private split proved to be the bedrock of 19th century middle-class culture. Only in private could Victorians express their intimate feelings of love and desire. This was one of my most important findings. Public expression in books, speeches, memoirs, even overland trail diaries, often intended to be read by a public audience, were not generalizable to the private realm. In middle-class America, mate selection had shifted from parental control to control of the children. Under parental control in the colonial era, the main criteria for choosing a mate had been economics, religion, and social class. The main criteria of marriage shifted in the first part of the 19th century in the American middle class to romantic love. Romantic love is a difficult concept because its meaning can vary over space and time. Using the same word does not guarantee the same meaning. Studying letters, I was able to construct the meaning that couples were using with each other at the time. What I found was that the 19th century version of romantic love was based upon a concept of the self that is anti-role. This means that the self of each individual was seen as a hidden essence, an authentic self that could not be fully expressed in public roles. The multiple demands of roles, such as friend, student, salesman, cook, worker, manager, and so on, your performing self did not define you according to this idea. The belief that there is an essence to you, an authentic self that transcends every role you participate in, but is, at its core, the real you, I call the romantic self. This idea of the romantic self is closely tied to the idea that completely unfettered and open communication of this core self should be reserved for intimates and defines intimacy. Thus, I discovered that the essential act of romantic love in 19th century middle class America was the freest, most open, and fullest communication of the authentic self to another. What I like to call the gift of self. As sex became highly romanticized in this culture, it was seen not just as an act, a physical act, or a physical sensation, but as the ultimate gift of self. Sex in Victorian America was wholeheartedly approved as an act of love and wholeheartedly condemned by the mainstream when bodily pleasures were not expressions of love. The evil of sexual promiscuity, seduction, or betrayal was not in the act itself, but in the spiritual violation of the person. Victorians did not denigrate sex. They guarded it. The highest value of individual expression and autonomous selfhood were heaped upon the erotic, which was seen as pure if it was an act of love. Thus, Victorian love letters are full of sex talk. Not, of course, in the language of a 21st century undergraduate at Creighton. But if you listen closely, you will hear their passion and sexual desire. Celebrating 11 years of marriage, Lincoln Clark, a circuit judge and lawyer, wrote to Julia, his wife, in 1847, "What would all this world be if we could not pour out the heart to those who care for us and who have given us evidence that they care for us by smiles in health and angelic devotion in sickness? I want to put my arms around your waist and kiss you and pat your black hair and say how sweet. It would do me just as much good as it did 10.5 years ago." That's how long we've been married. "And I have the vanity to believe that the pleasure would not be all on one side. And this idea enhances it to me. You say you cannot say you love. Well, I will say it. And you may express it as you please. The thing itself is the sunshine of earth." Though the expression is uncommonly fine, the investment of physical desire with the meaning of romantic love was not unusual. In 19th century American love letters, sex and romantic love were intertwined in the everyday system of cultural meaning. Mary Granger, a music teacher in Buffalo, waxed elegiac one Sunday evening in 1856 about her relationship with Lyman Hodge, a Yale graduate who eventually became a coffee and spice merchant in Minnesota. This is Mary. This afternoon, as I lay half asleep thinking of you, the meetings and walks that we took when you first began to love me came back oh so plainly. I thought of the words you said and the kisses you gave until it seemed to me that I could feel your arms around me and your kisses on my lips. Then it was all so new and strangely beautiful, and I loved you so much from the first that I did not for a long time think it would be a life blessing, but that I was too happy for this world and you never would love me well enough to make me your wife. And when that thought was dissipated, I felt that just to know that you loved me was happiness enough, even if we were never married. But now I do not feel exactly so about our marriage and know that choicest boon of love is yet to be ours. Now, no undergraduate today would call sexual consummation that choicest boon of love. But nonetheless, that's what she's talking about. It's kind of a nice phrase. Mary expressed a joyful anticipation of the physical consummation of her relationship with Lyman. Typically, she represented love through the physical dimension of her relationship. "And now, love, you with the warm heart and loving eyes," Lyman wrote Mary the following year from Minnesota, "whose picture I kissed last night and whose lips I so often kiss in my dreams, whose love enriches me so bountifully with all pleasant memories and sweet anticipations, whose encircling arms shield me from so much evil and harm, whose caresses are so dear and so longed for, awaken in slumber, making my heart beat faster, my flesh tremble, and my brain giddy with delight, whose feet I kiss and whose knees I embrace as a devotee kisses and embraces those of his idol, my darling, whose home is in my arms and whose resting place my bosom, who first came to them as a frightened bird but now longs to linger till long after the midnight chimes have uttered their warning. My life, with your generous womanly soul, my heart's keeper and my true love, good night. A good night and a fair one to thy sleeping eyes and wearied limbs, the precursor of many bright, beautiful mornings when my kisses shall waken thee and my love shall greet thee." In the experience of Victorian couples, sex was not only sensate and romantic, however, it was also the occasion for a good laugh. Perhaps my most surprising discovery was that Victorians had a sense of humor about their erotic life. I'll just give you a brief example. Alice Baldwin was a respectable army wife who conceived of her role as a strictly subordinate one in relationship to men. In other words, she was no feminist. This makes it all the more fascinating when, in 1870, she told her husband about a flashing she received in a train station. "There was a man showed his conflummox to me at one station where we stopped in Illinois while I was looking out of the window. I thought he might have saved himself the trouble because I had seen one before." In later letters, she taunted her husband after learning that he had wavered between marrying her or another woman, Nellie Smith. Alice used two slang terms: giving the mittens, which in the 19th century meant ending a relationship, and in our slang, we would say dumping someone. I don't think this is in our slang vocabulary. She also used the 19th century slang term old long tom, which is 19th century slang for a penis. "Aunt Mary said you asked her advice about it," Alice wrote. "You didn't know whether to marry her or me. Mr. Frank D. Baldwin, if I had known you was in such a quandary, I would have settled the matter at once by giving you the mittens. I felt real queer and strange when I heard you had half a mind to marry another girl. I thought I held undivided your love. Well, it's too late now. Nellie Smith don't know what she escaped. She would have been killed at one nab of your old long tom." Alice Baldwin turned the ideology of the Victorian lady upside down. For instead of deriding her rival as sexually loose or impure, she ridiculed her competitor's sexual inadequacy, and she also inadvertently perhaps, praised her husband's endowments. Such playfulness illustrates the multiple dimensions of sexuality in 19th century relationships. Now, beloved one of my heart, Emily Lovell, another traditional wife, closed a Civil War letter, embrace me and love me as I do desire. Kiss me over and over again while I say, beloved one, goodbye. I wrote you a darling one, she confessed. I wrote you, darling one, she confessed 2 days later, a little messenger yesterday, but on the arrival this morning of another song of love from thee, I could not help saying a few words. Would that I could kiss you all over and then eat you up. Emily openly avowed her sexual desires and characterized herself as a sexual aggressor. Her husband was very happy. Kiss me, dear sweetheart, 1,000 warm and loving kisses. Mansfield responded, take me to your beautiful arms and let me for a while enjoy a heaven upon earth. He encouraged Emily to play the active sexual role and reveled in the prospect of her sexual aggression. This exchange took place after 13 years of marriage. Victorian love letters often emphasized the mutual expression and pleasure of physical love. Clara Baker and Robert Burdett, in their letters, he called her, her name was Clara, but he called her by a pet name, Violet. Violet wanted to be loved. Clara Baker wrote enticingly about her sexual feelings in 1898, and kissed and petted. And Robert Burdett, a popular lecturer who eventually became a Presbyterian minister in Pasadena, responded, Violet must let me take off these things then, and this that is left I will gently raise out of my way till its fleecy folds lie above the milk-white breasts. How beautiful you are, my Violet. How delicately graceful are all the curves in your dear body. How smooth and satin-like. How ravishing the perfume of your breasts and this soft brown silken thicket that discloses and yet conceals your dash, dash. How strong are your clasping limbs, my Violet. So beautiful and so strong. Is that right, my darling? There, dear, do I hurt you, sweet? Hold me close, close then, my darling. And now, sweet Violet, my love phrases, my pettings and my kisses are raining on your silent face, and you are my sweetheart, and I am your lover. Robert Burdett was a man who opposed card playing, spoke out publicly against bicycle riding on Sunday, and received newspaper notices on the lecture circuit such as, quote, but here is a man who, if he could make a million men laugh at the cost of a single hidden tear from some poor stung one's eye, that tear would never fall, and his language is as clean as his thoughts are pure. This man, however, could luxuriate in the erotic freedom of the private sphere, the location where Victorians believed one could legitimately and fully express the romantic self. Who wants the most? Robert asked his fiancée as he pondered their comparative appetites for lovemaking. We'll make a little match someday. I will draw your dear, warm, throbbing body into my arms and nestle you up to me until swell and dimple, muscle and hollow fit into each other, and every breath and heart throb feels the other. And I will crush you to myself and fasten my lips to yours and see who can lie there the longest and do the most petting. Your petting, sweet Violet, will be prettiest, but mine will be the stronger. From your sweet brown hair to your dainty instep, I will kiss you, love, and I'll murmur 1,000 impassioned words with every kiss. I will bury my face in your fragrant hair and praise its silken beauty till your heart is aflame with love. I will clasp my arms around the dear rounded waist and belt it with a girdle of kisses. The swelling thighs shall taste my lips until you can stand no more of it, and then I will kiss your dimpled knees to rest you while I laugh with an overflow of joy and love. My little one, 10 kisses to your one, I will give you long, sweet, lingering, passionate kisses. We will love each other, my beloved betrothed, until love itself cries out in an agony of bliss, in the very pain of ecstasy. My Violet, oh Robert, it might be tempting to ridicule lines such as Robert's, the throbbing fountain of a woman's love. But this would likely risk missing the unselfconscious acceptance on Robert's part of the pleasure of their physical coupling. Clara was equally enthusiastic, but she had a worry. Such a lover, and such a fancy. I wonder sometimes how he dares to pen it all. What if other eyes should read? She asked presciently. If your fancy must run riot, and I'm not saying it isn't delicious to have it, pen the fancies by themselves. Clara urged Robert to compose his lovemaking on separate sheets so that she could destroy those pages and spare the rest. There were only 3 pages left, but I found them. It took me 6 months. This is a 300-box collection. Obviously, Clara missed a few pages, revealing more than she might have wished by what she called delicious. Victorian women could be enthusiastic and occasionally forceful in expressing their physical desire. Nonetheless, masculine sexual imagery tended to be more aggressive. Anticipating a long-awaited reunion with his fiancée in 1872, mining engineer James Haig reflected an active masculine style. Well, I hope I shall have my arms around the old girl herself before many weeks, and if I don't behave with great impropriety, then it will be for better reasons than I can now foresee. I'll just squeeze her and hug her and kiss her forehead and eyes. Yes, I'll kiss them again and again. And when I have looked at them to my heart's content, I'll kiss them again and her cheeks and lips and throat. And I'll take liberties with her hair and pull out her hairpins and tousle and tumble her up generally until she boxes my old ears and goes upstairs to set herself straight. Won't that be nice, old loveliness? Glorified, exalted, ecstatic, radiant, and don't I wish I was there now? It would be a mistake, however, to draw the contrast between the expressive styles of Victorian men and women too starkly. Augusta Halleck, a prosperous farmer's daughter, remembers her courtship antics with James Bell. Well, I'm naughty enough to say that I mean to bite you the first chance I get. Now depend on it, Augusta teased. I haven't forgotten what a delight it was for me years ago and what a powerful effect this biting had on you. More than a year later, Gusta laments that she is losing her teeth, to which James responded with a chuckle. Thinks I, he retorts, you can't bite my neck now. But I have the start of you on that, for I lost part of mine 10 years ago. What, you losing your teeth too? Gusta responded to her boyfriend. Seems to me we will make a pretty-looking couple. They were young, gray and toothless too. We both labor under the same difficulties, you see, but I mean to bite your neck if I have to get false ones to do it. Before marriage, a time was set aside by Victorian culture to develop romantic love between two young people who hoped to marry. Usually at least a year-long process, it was a private, unchaperoned experience that encouraged the growth of both physical and emotional intimacy, though intercourse was a physical boundary that was not supposed to be crossed until marriage. The central ritual of this Victorian courtship was the testing of emotional loyalty and commitment. Which made it an intensely dramatic and exciting period of interaction. Women, being economically dependent upon their husband after marriage, put men through a series of more rigorous tests of love, involving obstacles that the men had to overcome, at least through verbal reassurance. I'll give you an extreme example. One woman used her ill health to create a notable test of her fiancé's love. Mary announced in a letter written September 15, 1871, that she would probably be an invalid for life, therefore she was releasing her fiancé from any obligation he might feel to marry her. Suddenly, her letter ended in mid-sentence, but she mailed the missive. James wrote back, "You couldn't have chosen a more dreadful place to leave off." He had been given the ultimate courtship test, Would he marry her even if she might be an invalid for life? The melodramatic quality of the question illustrates, again, the dramas that 19th century women often staged in testing men during courtship. Before I go on, any men in the room, Valentine's Day is a test. Just remember. Here is part of James' response to this letter that ended in mid-sentence, I'm going to be an invalid for life, so I release you. I do not know myself well enough to answer for years to come. I am too sensible of the changes that time works to be certain that the feelings and motives and impulses of the present moment will endure unaltered through life. But this much I do know. I know my present mind and purpose, and that is, if I were called upon tonight to sacrifice, as you say, my future to your happiness and welfare, I should not hesitate a moment. I have no more cherished purpose in my future than to devote myself and my life to you. No more desired object than to enjoy and to be worthy of your earnest, hearty love and intimate affection. James passed by affirming his love for her in the medium she had chosen to test him in, sickness. Other mediums included debt. I'm so much in debt, we can't get married. I'm calling off the engagement. Family, my father's an alcoholic and I can't ask you to marry me. Remember, they're all always engaged before this happens. Debt, family, other men, religious difference, character flaws, and personal inadequacies all form the plot material of Victorian women's tests of love during middle-class courtship. However rigorously the women tested the men during courtship, romantic love in Victorian marriage was inherently unstable. It might last a lifetime or be gone in 6 months or less. And the tragedy of our cultural conception of love is like theirs. Victorian shrouded romantic love in mystery, in inexplicable chemistry. They saw it as will-less, that is, beyond individual control. 19th century middle-class marriage was based upon an atomistic ideal of two individuals mysteriously but permanently bonded by romantic love. The strain of this belief system was that though love had become the central cultural rationale for marriage, there was no basis in the conception of love itself for repairing or fixing it. Because romantic love was believed to be essentially beyond individual control, it was extremely difficult to hold the individual accountable for its loss. Understandably, then, romantic love was not conceived of as a duty, but was nonetheless joined to a marital institution steeped in dutiful human relationships. Is it any wonder that the divorce rate began to increase in the 19th century and has skyrocketed in the 20th? All this and much more I found in the pages of 19th century love letters that found their way, often quite by accident, to the archives of the Huntington Library. But what has happened to love letters since the Victorian era? What has remained the same or changed significantly in the intimate lives of most Americans? In my judgment, the most significant change has been in our sense of privacy. I could do a whole paper on that. What's remained the same, in spite of Alexander Graham Bell and all the forms of electronic communication that followed his invention, is that Americans in the 20th century, at least, continued to write love letters, especially when they were separated by war. The question is, will they end up on a trash heap somewhere? My mother was a pack rat. She saved everything. Conceding to the space requirements of a small house only by moving the effluvium out to the garage. Whereupon my father secretly disposed of items in order to make room for more of her treasures. This system worked well until my mother decided to retrieve a buried treasure. After a fruitless search in the garage, she was on red alert, and my father had to call upon all his reserves of charm to placate her suspicion that he had once again callously tossed a famous bric-a-brac which had been sitting unused for 5 years. Some things my mother saved, however, and were never consigned to the garage. They lay undisturbed in the recesses of her closet for many years, and thus remained within the circle of safety. As she aged, she began to survey and sort her housebound treasures. Over the telephone, she spoke often of the piles of family photographs that she was busy sorting, labeling, and organizing in albums. She even began playing the box of old 78 RPM records stored in the linen closet. Some of the students in this room have no idea what I'm talking about. One day, out of the blue, she told me shyly that she had found a bunch of love letters from my father. "How wonderful," I exclaimed. "Yes," she giggled, "I'm reading them out loud to your father." He was amazed, she reported, at how much he had forgotten about his World War II experience. Both of them had a great time revisiting their intimate past. "What are you planning to do with them?" I asked expectantly. She seemed a little confused and hesitated. Suddenly, a dreadful thought entered my mind. "You're not going to destroy them, are you?" I blurted out in a mournful bellow. "We'll see," my mother responded slowly and deliberately. "Please, Mother, please," I begged. "You just can't destroy those letters. Remember, your daughter is a historian who uses love letters in her work." I pleaded. "It would be sacrilegious," I spluttered. "You'll tear my heart out." She remained silent as the Sphinx. "Feel sort of helpless right now," one 20th century lover began his letter. "As I know, even if I write till eternity, I could never express the way I feel toward you. Lil, I thought I loved you and knew what love was, but on those priceless 7 days I spent with you, I found something I don't think I ever had before, something precious, wonderful, something more than life itself. Our love, Lil. That very something, dearest, which I found, and I may say I hope we found together during those 7 days at home. I dreamt many, many nights of coming home and holding you close, dearest, and knew it was going to be wonderful, but not the 7 days of heaven I was in when I was home with you. For you see, Lil, Jim needs you now. You're all mine, Lil. You're part of me now forever. Every living moment, it's you, you, you." 18 months later, the same man wrote, "I'm a very selfish guy. I want all of you, Lil. That sweet smile, the look from those blue eyes, that laugh, the sweetness, every bit of you, Lil. Your heart, your body, your soul. I need them, Lil. I need you to the gal I love with all my heart. May the day come soon when I hold you in my arms and have that dream come true. My wife till eternity." Lil was my mother. And the man who wrote those letters during World War II, the first in July 1944 and the second in February 1946, was my soldier father. She did not destroy the letters. Even more unexpectedly, some of her letters survive. My father had managed to bring a few of them home from the Second World War. One written in 1946 closes, "Jim, are you listening? As I whisper in your ear, I love you, Jim, and I'm waiting for you. You're all I want, yours till the birds fail to sing." Throughout the 20th century, Americans wrote love letters when they were separated for long stretches of time. I'm certain there are untold stashes of World War I, stashes of World War I, World War II, Korean, Vietnam, and Gulf War love letters in private hands, needing to be saved and archived. But I'm less certain about the last 15 years. Skype was launched in 2003, Facebook in 2004, Twitter in 2006, Instagram in 2010. Are love letters even written in the digital age when Skype is available on almost any computer and both domestic and international cell phone calls are relatively cheap and accessible, not to mention texts, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. My answer, somewhat tentatively, is maybe. In 2006, Lee Thornton, a gunner in the Iraq War, wrote a letter to his fiancée. "You have shown me what love is and what it feels like to be loved," he told Helen. "Every time you kissed me and our lips touched so softly I could feel it. I got the same magical feeling as our first kiss. I could feel it when our hearts got so close they are beating as one. You are the beat of my heart, the soul in my body. You are me, because without you I am nothing. I love you, Helen. When I am away, it is like I have left my soul by your side." This letter was delivered to Lee Thornton's fiancée on his instructions after he died. His love letter was a gift of self to Helen, who was willing to share his love with us after his death. Perhaps you or members of your family have written love letters that you would be willing to share one day. This might enable historians to challenge absurd stereotypes, such as the passionlessness of Victorian women, which can sometimes substitute for historical evidence. They will be able to create a more accurate, nuanced understanding of love, courtship, marriage, and intimate relationships in the 20th and 21st centuries. I hope that, like my mother, you will not be able to obliterate what those letters, if you have them, represent about your life or those you love. Verbal, as well as nonverbal communication, aimed at self-expression and disclosing true feeling, was the central convention of Victorian romantic love. In this sense, many of us are still Victorian and are shaped by the contours of romantic love as surely as we are molded by technology and finance. David Hare, a contemporary British playwright, has summarized the importance of romantic love, even in today's world. Quote, "If you do not live through a war, or are not overwhelmed by the loss of someone through some terrible accident, it is likely that romantic love will be the most profound thing that happens to you in your life." One Victorian woman marveled, "Strange things hearts are." I think you will agree, hearts are strange and wonderful indeed. Thank you. I apologize for getting choked up about my parents' love letters. I just read them for the first time to do this paper.
I'm just wondering why, for such a long time, did we presume that public manners in Victorian America represented private manners? You partly addressed this part of the question at the end of your talk, but I'm wondering, what do you think happened in the 20th century to remove that barrier between the public and private self? And the sort of the related third part is, how can we be so sure now that middle-class Americans still don't have a very private self that they keep concealed?
Let me answer all of them. They're all very good questions. It's a complex answer, but I'll say that in colonial America, you did not have this public-private split. So people saw the self of other people as totally and fully expressed in their roles. This split came about, and we need more actually scholarship on how and why. But I believe it was in place by the 1830s for the middle class, not for the working class, by the way. I'm doing a book on the working class, and it was not in place yet for them. So that may be one reason that coming out of the colonial period, they weren't as aware of this split. The second reason is that, and I wished I could be, I wish this was a kinder answer to my fellow historians, but I'll be frank. It's a lot easier to read some advice books on the shelf. They're easily accessed, and the 19th century advisors talked a lot about sex in their way. And it's easier to read them than to do the work to find these letters. So I think that's another answer. And third, I have done, as part of my book, I have done a study of the advice books because I was very curious. And there are three, what they did, which was even more egregious, is they took what I would call the conservative wing of the of advisors. There was the radical enthusiasts who thought that everyone should be having sex all the time, men and women, and they were enthusiastic. They thought it was healthy. Then there's the middle, who I'll get to. And then there were the conservative, the very far right wing. And the very far right wing was fun to deal with. They said things like, one of my favorites was John Cowan, who said, Americans should only have sex once every 3 years. Now that's fun. But what's even, but when you look at, when you read his book, what's interesting is he spends a whole chapter getting prepared for it at 11 a.m. It's obsessive in a in another kind of a way, and they didn't get that, and it was fun to look at this lurid sexual advice on the right, and so I think all of that added up to why I'm afraid that, and also of course, when paradigms get formed, they stick. We don't give them up easily. In point of fact, this paradigm is still widespread. I feel like going on a missionary tour around the country to try to shake it loose. It's still quite firmly in many historians' minds, it's still there. Your second question, I'm glad you asked, because I believe that the public-private split started to collapse in the 1920s. And it's continued its collapse to this day. There's more and more sex allowed in public. I mean, Victorians did everything they could to keep sex out of the public realm. This didn't mean that they didn't enjoy it in private, but it was not something to be talked about in public. And today, our public sex talk is quite open, I think. Ironically, I think that means that our private sex talk may be less erotic. I'll go on the record there. Because it's so open today. And this has been a slow process, but the 1920s started it, I believe. Now, your third question, I believe that most Americans throughout the 20th century were Victorian in many ways, and that anybody over 40 is still Victorian. I may push it down to 30, but I'm not certain my students are Victorian. I think there may be another very important historical change going on. I'm not certain, though, and here's why I'm uncertain. Because the average marriage age for women in America today, I need to stay behind the podium for the mic. The average marriage age is 27 for women and 29 for men. And my students are 18 to 21 to 22. They have not yet, if they're going to, they've not yet fallen in love. They don't really, no offense, Creighton students, many of them do not yet know what love is. And so when they talk about it with me, the dialogue is they dialogue with me, it's unclear what's going to happen to them at 25 or 27 or 29. So I do know that on Facebook, you are a performing self at all times. And many of my students get that distinction. When I talk about the distinction between being on Facebook and being with your closest friends in a more authentic way, they get that distinction. So that distinction is still out there. I am not giving up hope. That's why I said tentatively, maybe it may still be the case that we are still Victorian. I hope that partially answers. Thank you.
Did you find the same parallel with poetry and literature in general from 1830 to 1910, say? You know, I think of the Scarlet Letter in 1849 is right in the middle, kind of, and that touched that a little bit about the public and the private.
Literature totally parallels the Victorian culture and reflects it in so many ways. And in fact, you have to ask, one of the things you need to ask is, well, how do people learn these concepts, these ideas, this way to see the world? And one of the ways they learn it is through fiction. Of course, they also learn it through music, and I suppose you could say today music is our students' poetry. For those of you who don't know, the 19th century was a poetry-saturated place to live. Poetry was everywhere. Everywhere. In the lowliest penny magazine to the highest literary production, everybody did poetry. My working class correspondents write to each other, and they do write, even if they're illiterate. And their favorite poem is, "When this you see, remember me, though many a mile apart we be." Now, it isn't middle class poetry, but it says a lot to them. So poetry definitely parallels this belief system, and so does literature.
But not much erotic poetry, as you say.
Well, the problem is that you have this public-private split. So in point of fact, in Victorian culture, there is apparently quite a large production of, quote, I want to put in quotes, pornographic literature. I don't read it here, but it does exist.
I'd like to thank all of you for coming, and I would especially like to thank Professor Lystra for a lecture that has got me wanting to re-examine all of my embedded paradigms and write a love letter all at the same time.
Go so write a love letter for Valentine's Day.
That's, I guess that's... Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the annual Henry W. Casper S.J. Lecture in History. Today's speaker has been Karen Lystra, Professor of American Studies at California State University at Fullerton, and author of Searching the Heart, Women, Men, and Dramatic Love in 19th Century America, and Dangerous Intimacy, The Untold Story of Mark Twain's Final Years. Dr. Lystra spoke on the topic Love Letters, Revealing the Intimate Past. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, February 13, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Interim Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.